long sleeves, daisies in her hair, and a corsage of white carnations. Her cheerleader's costume was a long-sleeved red sweater, a swingy red and white miniskirt, red and white saddle shoes, and huge matching pom-poms. Dana had been in love with Mark Rutledge, a tall, dark-haired basketball star, for as long as she could remember. Everyone who knew them assumed they would get married within a few years of graduation. In the meantime, they dated, and Dana sold cosmetics and cut hair. After high school, she still entered beauty pageants, but where she had been merely pretty, Dana had become startlingly beautiful. Her hair was a few shades blonder, and her gowns were sewn with glittering sequins. She strutted along the runways with more confidence now, even during the bathing suit competition of the Miss Oregon U.S. pageant. The audience was more sophisticated, but she was still having fun. Dana had no particular aspirations beyond marriage and babies. I really loved Mark, and my parents thought that living in sin was wrong. I was 20 when we got married. It was July 26, 1986. How could I ever forget that date? It was a beautiful wedding. Mark wore white tails, and Dana's dress had a flouncy lace train. She carried a white lace fan decorated with pink flowers as her father walked her down the aisle. Her mother and her bridesmaids wore gowns of pale dusty rose. It should have been a happy ending, but it wasn't. Mark was a workaholic. I mean, he worked 80 hours a week, Dana said. We bought a nice home with land in a little town 20 miles north of Portland, but I was alone there all the time. Mark worked on projects in Las Vegas or in California, and he couldn't even come home on weekends. He told me there was no point. He'd just get home Saturday and have to fly back on Sunday. He came home about once a month. Dana knew that Mark worked all the time before she married him, but as so many women before her have believed, she thought marriage would change him. "He didn't change," she said. "I couldn't go out because I was married, and besides, I didn't want to. I wanted children. I wasn't a women's liber. I believed a woman should stay home, but I couldn't have babies with Mark. I would have had to raise them alone. I felt he was hurting me." The marriage was probably doomed from the beginning. It just kind of wore itself out by September 1988. Dana moved to Portland and got a job selling high-end cosmetics in a department store. Sometimes she cut hair to supplement her income. "I sold Estee Lauder. I went to the brands and the stores where I could make money." Dana was divorced from Mark in 1989. It was not an acrimonious divorce, not at all. "We're still great friends today," she said. "We just couldn't be married." Deep down, Dana knew she was pretty, but she wondered if she had anything else to offer. Her own husband hadn't cared enough about her to come home more than once a month, even during the honeymoon phase of their brief marriage. Her confidence was shaken, and she was particularly vulnerable to men who responded positively to her. She dated some. Men came on to her everywhere she turned. There was one man, Nick Ronzini, who sold men's clothes in the department store where she worked. Dana liked Nick a lot, and he was very handsome, but when he drank, his personality changed. Dana was at a crossroads in 1990. If nothing came along to change her life, she might stay with Nick, or she might go home to Southern Oregon and stay with her family. As it turned out, someone did come along. Brad Cunningham. "He called me and told me that he remembered me," Dana said, even though there had been people standing in line for the nanny job. She had almost forgotten that she had applied for the job. When she went to the Dunthorpe house for her second interview, Brad told her that he was separated from his wife, Dr. Sarah Gordon. "We aren't getting along," he said. "I live here with my sons." Dana assumed that the huge home with its sprawling grounds and two-story guest house belonged to Brad. She found him very distinguished. Brad was 41 in the spring of 1990, but he didn't look it. He was running 10 miles a day and was in peak condition. He dressed in expensive dark suits and drove a new rented Mercedes. He was so charming, Dana said, but he was humble, too, and quiet. When Brad told her that she had won the nanny job over all the other applicants, Dana was thrilled, but she looked upon it only as a job. She would care for his 3 little boys during the week and live in the guest house, but she planned to continue her job selling cosmetics on the weekends. Sarah had to sell the Dunthorpe house. The cash drain of the bakery and then the bistro was bad enough, but the payments on the big house, not to mention the taxes, were more than she could handle, even if she worked 24 hours a day. But Brad blocked her every attempt to sell the house. It was outrageous, and it was ridiculous, but Sarah understood. She knew Brad's charisma, and she had learned how frightening and relentless he could be to get what he wanted. If she had not had Jack Kincaid to back her up, she might have buckled under the pressure. Sarah's money had paid for the Dunthorpe house and the River Place apartment, but she no longer lived in either. In truth, she really didn't live anywhere. She was a woman in hiding. The few items she had managed to take out of the Dunthorpe house were in the River Place apartment, but she wasn't. Instead, she slept at Providence Hospital, feeling some slight sense of protection with her co-workers surrounding her. She never slept in the suite she had shared so many times with Brad and the little boys. Brad knew where that was, and there was always the chance he might encounter some new employee who didn't know about him and talk his way into the suite. Sarah knew what a glib talker he was, so she slept behind doors that were behind doors that were behind doors, deep in the bowels of the hospital. If anyone called for her, anyone, the ground rules now demanded that the caller never be told where she was. All of her calls were transferred to trusted friends inside Providence. Only then would the call be passed on to her. Once again, Sarah's work was her life, just as it had been when she first met Brad in 1986. However, by 1990, she no longer took her life for granted. The memories of being able to concentrate on her work, to walk without fear into the parking lot, to live without fear in her own home, were only that. Memories. Somehow Brad always seemed to be aware of where she was. Sarah never knew what she might find. Sometimes she found black spray paint along the sides of both her cars, an Audi and a Volvo, sometimes splashes of paint across their hoods, the edges drying into segmented clots the way blood dries. The cars were white, and she saw the damage immediately. It didn't matter where she parked. Once, when she had spent the night at a girlfriend's house, she found that 12 nails had been pounded into her tires. For some reason, the tires hadn't gone flat, and she was able to drive to a tire dealer and have them repaired. But worst, because of what they symbolized, were the flower petals. Some unseen hand had sprinkled rose petals all over her car as if casting flowers on a grave. Even when she went to bed in one of the on-call suites deep in the inner sanctum of the hospital, Sarah didn't sleep well. It was hard not to think of all she had lost. Most of all, she missed her sons. If I hadn't been afraid of Brad, I would have sought custody of the boys, but I didn't dare. Sarah harbored the hope that she might have Jess, Michael, and Philip for 3 weeks in June. Seeing the boys meant seeing Brad, but she wasn't afraid of him in the daylight. It was the unexpected that frightened her. Brad would never let her have the children for long periods, but he allowed short visits. Meanwhile, their divorce proceedings inched along. An uncontested divorce in Oregon took only 3 months, but Brad claimed federal law guidelines and said his pending bankruptcy gave him an automatic stay, and as usual, he changed attorneys. It would be fall at least before Sarah could hope to have her divorce finalized. On June 10th, Sarah met Dana Malloy when she returned the boys to the Dunthorpe house after they had visited her. The two women liked each other, and Sarah went away somewhat relieved at Brad's choice of a caregiver for the boys. She noticed one thing that shouldn't have surprised her. Dana looked a lot like herself, same coloring, same general facial features. Dana was taller, of course, and about 10 years younger than she was, but their resemblance was remarkable. Sarah was glad she liked Dana, but if she hadn't, it wouldn't have mattered to Brad. He no longer listened to anything she said. Dana had settled happily into her job at the Dunthorpe house. If she couldn't have babies of her own, Brad's sons were great little kids, and she soon became very attached to them. She looked after Jess, Michael, and Philip, saw that they got to school, cooked, washed dishes, and made the beds. The work wasn't hard, and Dana enjoyed being with this little motherless family. She didn't know, of course, that there had been two mothers whom Brad had ruthlessly cut out of their lives. Before a month had passed, Dana was surprised but a little pleased, too, when it became obvious that Brad was attracted to her. "When I went to work for him, I had my own life," she said. "I had my weekend job. He didn't even know me, but within a month, he didn't want me working weekends. He got obsessed with me. I guess that's how you'd describe it. He put me on a pedestal. He wouldn't let me make beds or wash the dishes. After I was with him 30 days, he hired Molly Maid to come in. But cleaning was supposed to be part of my job." Dana believed that Brad was a wealthy businessman. She had no idea that the house they lived in belonged to Sarah and that Brad had no income at all beyond $1,608 a month he collected in Social Security survivors' benefits for Cheryl Keaton's boys and the sporadic payments that he got from the Colville tribe. Brad began to court Dana avidly, and she was dazzled. "He ordered these exotic flowers flown in from Hawaii, flowers I'd never seen before. I didn't even know you could buy flowers that way." The five of them, Brad, Dana, Jess, Michael, and Philip, went out to dinner often as a family. It was pleasant and fun, and Dana found herself falling in love with Brad. It wasn't much more than a month after she began working for him that they became intimate. "He was a wonderful lover. A passionate lover. When he kissed you, you believed you were the only woman in the world for him." Dana had been ignored by her husband, but now she had become the center of Brad's universe, completely unaware of the bitter divorce and the terrible struggle he and Sarah were having over the house. Dana never knew about things like that. Brad took care of his own business affairs. He dictated what they would do, where they would go, how she would dress, whom she would see. She was so happy to be with him that she didn't notice how short her leash was becoming. Life with Brad was sheer joy, but it wasn't perfect. Dana's awe of him lasted for a relatively brief time, and some things really bothered her. She didn't like the way Brad disciplined his sons, even though he seemed to love them. She watched him administer the precise number of swats that he had toted up during the boys' lapses when they were away from home. Once they knew that punishment was awaiting them, most of the fun of their outings vanished, and Dana was as horrified as Sarah had been to see another form of control. For some minor misdeed, Brad would order the miscreant to stand inches from a wall, warning him that he must not allow his nose to touch the wall itself. "Sometimes they'd have to stand that way for an hour," Dana said. "Even Philip." Brad was their father, Dana knew, and she never interfered, but it bothered her to see a little boy like Philip doing his time against the wall like a Marine recruit. Sometime in the summer of 1990, Brad announced that they were all moving to Seattle. Dana assumed that he must have sold the Dunthorpe house and agreed to go with him. The move caught Sarah completely by surprise and added to her torment. "The last time I saw the boys was July 8, 1990, she remembered. "After that, it would be such a long, long time before I saw them. I didn't have any idea where they were." On that Sunday, July 8th, Sarah brought the boys back to Dunthorpe and saw a large U-Haul truck parked down the street. A little alarm sounded in her brain. Later, she learned that Brad had pulled it into the driveway and packed it full. Before he, Dana, and the boys pulled out, he told the security force at Dunthorpe that he was putting a few things in storage and taking his sons to Canada for a vacation. He said there would be no way to contact him, and he didn't know when he would return. When Sarah called the Dunthorpe house 2 days later, she found the phone had been disconnected. She went to the house with two realtors and discovered that once again all the locks had been changed to high-security locks, which were almost impossible to disable. In order to get in, she had to break a window in the laundry room. The house was a mess. But she didn't know if Brad was gone for good. He had left a house-sitter in the place. Sure enough, he returned on July 14th and hooked up the phone. When Sarah called him to once again discuss listing the house, he was curt. "Am I going to see the boys for dinner?" she asked.
"Not unless you want to go to Bellingham."
Bellingham was 300 miles north of Portland.
"Brad, you're disobeying court orders by taking them away," Sarah countered.
He hung up on her. Neighbors called Sarah to tell her that Brad had had movers at the house and had hauled away a tremendous load of stuff. He had told his renter in the guest house that he was moving to Seattle for 6 to 10 months to sell a drug product. Sarah asked the security patrol to check the house. They reported that the key she had given them still fit in the lock in the back door, but Brad had apparently done something to the door so that it wouldn't open. All the windows on the ground floor had also been nailed shut. When Sarah finally gained entry to the house, she was stunned. The place had been gutted. "Besides removing all of his furniture and personal belongings," she wrote shakily in her journal, "Brad removed the washer, dryer, and refrigerator, a $3,000 armoire, $1,800 china cabinet and $600 coffee table that I purchased prior to our marriage. Most surprising, he cut wires and totally removed 2 Genie garage door opening systems. All the closet components, shelves et al., installed by Closets to Go." Brad had pried out the fireplace insert, taken down light fixtures, and generally dismantled and removed everything that could possibly be carried away. Light bulbs, fireplace screens, towel racks. Sarah couldn't imagine what use he had for them. No, Brad was simply leaving his signature. On July 18th, Sarah went to get the Ford truck she had bought Brad from the World Trade Center parking lot where he said he had left it. She felt fortunate that he had obeyed a court order to return the dark blue one-ton pickup truck that she was paying for. It was there, still with Brad's vanity plate that said, B-B-I-I-G-G. "The pickup wouldn't start and was towed to Coliseum Ford," Sarah noted in her diary. "They found that both gas tanks contained at least 50% water." It would cost at least $500 to get the truck running again. None of it mattered to Sarah as much as the fact that her 3 little boys had once again vanished, and she had no idea how long it would be until she saw them again. Chapter 44. As they moved through 1990, Mike Shinn, Diane Baker, and Shinn's private detectives quite possibly learned more about Brad Cunningham than anyone ever had. Perhaps confident that the police had long since lost interest in him as a suspect in Cheryl's murder, Brad, for a time, had not been as careful of his movements as he had once been. But now that the civil action had been filed against him, Shinn was always right behind him, and Brad was once again moving frequently. Shinn had yet to wrest so much as one deposition from him. Forrest Reiki's law firm no longer represented Brad, not since Sarah's attorney, Bill Schulte, informed them that she would not be paying his legal bills, and he and the boys had abruptly moved to Washington State.
In May of 1990, Shin believed he had finally succeeded in getting Brad to give a deposition. It meant that Shin had to travel to Seattle to obtain it, but it was worth the 200-mile trip. He arrived at the appointed place and time, and at the last minute, Brad did appear, carrying some kind of legal document.
"There," he exclaimed, and threw the document on the table. "There will be no deposition. I have an automatic stay of all legal action."
The document was a Chapter 7 bankruptcy filing. By switching from his Chapter 11 bankruptcy action to the Chapter 7, Brad had indeed removed himself from the requirement of giving a deposition in the civil action against him concerning Cheryl's murder. Without Sarah's support, Brad argued, correctly, he had no funds. And he would not have funds until his pending Houston suit came to fruition. As a virtual indigent, without legal counsel and protected by Chapter 7, he was temporarily untouchable. To the best of Shin's knowledge, he had seen Brad only twice, once when he came over to his restaurant table in Portland, and once when he slapped his Chapter 7 papers down on the conference table in Seattle. Shin began to wonder if it was humanly possible to get Cunningham into a courtroom. The guy wasn't an attorney, but he had been involved in so much litigation over the years that he was savvy about how to delay and distract. Shin became a regular in bankruptcy court in Seattle, appearing several times over the next 6 months to file motions to lift the stay. Finally, in December of 1990, Judge Samuel J. Steiner did accede to Shin's motions. Brad named a date when his Houston trial would take place, and then ignored one deposition request after another. For Shin, it was like jousting with a shadow. That fall, Mike Shin had learned to his disgust that the date Brad had given for his civil suit against the Parkwood Place contractor and the bonding company in Texas was false. There was no trial date set in Houston, but Shin moved steadily ahead on the civil case in Oregon. Depositions or not, Brad was going to have to answer questions he had avoided for 4 years. Shin wanted to recreate, if he could, the events of September 21st, 1986. He had to prove that it was possible for Brad to have left his sons, or at least Jess and Philip, in his apartment in the Madison Tower and driven to the mobile station on the West Slope to confront Cheryl Keaton. He had to allow time for the killer to strike the victim more than 20 times, send her van onto the freeway, run back to the mobile station, and then drive home and answer Sarah Gordon's phone call at 8:50 p.m. If that wasn't possible, Shin wouldn't have a case. Lilia had seen Brad at 7:30. The window of opportunity was, almost certainly, little more than an hour and 15 minutes. It was now the third week of September, 1990. No moment in time is ever exactly like any other. No sunset or sunrise, no ebb and flow of tide. But Shin chose the night of September 21st, 1990, to run his test. Conditions were as close as he could get to the night Cheryl was murdered. The weather was almost the same, warm and pleasant. Only it was 4 years later, and September 21st was a Friday, not a Sunday. Traffic would be a little heavier. At 7 p.m., the test car pulled up to the exit of the parking garage at the Madison Tower. The man who was playing the killer was driving. Shin was in the back seat. It was still full daylight, and there were two reasons why Shin figured that Brad would not have left the Madison Tower until an hour later. He would have waited for darkness to carry out a murder, and Betty Trosseth had talked to Cheryl just before 8 on the night she was murdered. The last thing Cheryl had said to her mother was, "I'm going to meet Brad at the mobile station." Diane Baker was playing the victim in the test. Shortly after 8 p.m., the time when Cheryl had ended her conversation with her mother, she left the West Slope house that Cheryl had rented. Driving a Toyota van, Diane clocked the distance to the mobile station at 0.7 miles.
It took just a couple of minutes to get down there, she remembered.
She parked the van and waited. 80700. It is dusk when Shin and the killer pull out of the Madison Tower parking area and head for the Sunset Highway. They will be careful to travel at legal speeds. A camcorder in their car automatically registers the passing of seconds and minutes. 80944. The arrow to 26 West appears. The car moves left onto the approach toward the westbound tunnel. 81328. The car emerges from the tunnel and onto the Sunset Highway. The speed is 55 miles an hour. 81632. They reach the location of the mobile station. 81700. They pull in and park in the shadows there. The killer slips on gloves. He walks slowly around from the back of the station to the victim's van parked out front. He pounds on the victim's window, forcing his way in.
I was trying to think as Cheryl would have that night, Baker remembered. I sat in the van waiting, looking all around for Brad, but even though I was waiting for someone to attack me, I didn't see him. He was just there suddenly.
81820. He is inside the van. This period could never be absolutely reconstructed. Had Brad pulled up close to Cheryl's van so that she could see that Michael was in the car? Or had he left Michael with orders to take a nap in Sarah's car behind the station? Or conceivably, could he have left all three boys in his apartment? Furthermore, no one could really know where the savage beating of Cheryl Keaton had taken place. More than likely it was a continuous attack in the van, although she might well have tried desperately to leap from the passenger door, only to be yanked back by the belt of her jeans. Her injuries had been inflicted by a heavy object. Shin was inclined to believe it was a police-type flashlight, although he could never locate it. 82210. The victim's van, with the killer at the wheel and the victim dead or unconscious in the passenger seat, is stopped on 79th Street, a minute or two away from the mobile station. The eastbound lanes of the Sunset Highway are just ahead. 82248. The killer sends the van toward the freeway. He then jogs back toward the mobile station. He's wearing shorts and a t-shirt now and carrying a bundle of clothes under his arm like a football. 83050. The killer arrives back at the mobile station where his car is parked. 83228. The killer gets in his car, checks traffic carefully, pulls out of the mobile station, and heads toward the Sunset Highway going east. He is slightly out of breath from his jog. 83740. The killer is back on the Sunset Highway, headed east toward the Madison Tower. 83813. He is in the tunnel going east. 84207. He pulls into the Madison Tower parking garage. 84234. He exits his parked car. The reenactment of Cheryl's murder was only a drama. It wasn't real, but it seemed real. I relived it, Shin recalled. I was sweating. My heart was pounding like crazy, even though we knew it was just a reenactment. It was almost as if it was really happening. Brad could have easily been back in the Madison Tower garage at 8:42 p.m. In 2 more minutes, he would have been able to ride the elevator to the 18th floor and enter his apartment in time to take a phone call, with 10 minutes to spare. If Brad hadn't answered the phone when Sarah called just before 9, Shin commented, he would not have locked himself into such a tight time frame. But it was loose enough. The test run had proved that it was indeed possible to drive from the Madison Tower to the West Slope and back in 35 minutes, even allowing for almost 5 minutes in which to strike a helpless victim almost 2 dozen times. But if Brad was Cheryl's killer, he may not have had 10 minutes to spare. Later, experts estimated that it would take almost 15 minutes to bludgeon someone 24 times. In late 1990, Mike Shinn's office was in the Bishop's House in a remodeled parish house that was once a part of a church complex. Because it had been built in a time when crime in Portland was not a major concern, the Bishop's House had had to be beefed up with security devices. Iron grills were placed over windows on the ground and second floors, not just in Shinn's offices, but for all the offices located in the building. Brad Cunningham was a man who resented anyone snooping into his business and his life. Judging by the huge stack of reports from Connie Capato and Leslie Haig, there was ample evidence that Shinn had done both, and the civil trial was fast approaching. It seemed a wise thing that his office was secure. Diane Baker began to receive obscene phone calls at Shinn's office. The male voice was Asian, or at least disguised to sound Asian. "I know who you are," he breathed. "And I'm going to come up there and rape you." He added some ugly details about what he planned to do. By the third call, Baker was ready for him. She kept saying, "I can't understand you. Could you repeat that? Only slowly." And every time the obscene caller tried again, she pretended she couldn't understand the string of obscenities he uttered because of his accent. "I don't think it was Brad," she recalled, "but maybe it was someone Brad hired. The guy finally got so exasperated with me because I couldn't understand him that he hung up. That was the end of the phone calls." But not the end of the pre-trial incidents. Diane Baker went to work early one morning and found Mike Shinn's office a mess. Someone had come in during the night, someone with a very explicit mission. It was easy enough to find the point of entry. Powerful arms had twisted the iron bars away from the bathroom window of the second floor complex. Someone broke the window to the bathroom and took powdered cream and sugar from next to the coffee machine in the hall and scattered it all over the hall and Mike's office, Baker said. They didn't touch the other two attorneys' offices. What was odd and disturbing was that nothing of value was missing. There were computers, typewriters, all manner of office machines, and Shinn had any number of paintings and sculptures in his offices that were worth thousands of dollars. The intruder had taken nothing, nor had he damaged anything in Shinn's offices. He seemed rather to have broken in just to leave a message. "The only thing that was disturbed," Shinn said, "was the Brad Cunningham case file. Whoever broke in had taken that from where I kept it and scattered it all over the hall. That was what was under all that spilled sugar and cream. Whoever came in during the night may have read the file, but he didn't take it away with him. He just left it in sheets scattered all over my office, like a calling card." Shinn figured he must be getting to somebody, forcing him to look over his shoulder and annoying the hell out of him, but he was not about to quit. He was hot on the trail. Someone was hot on his trail, too. His car was broken into, not at his office, but where it was parked near his houseboat. The message was clear. "I know where you work, and I know where you live." Mike Shinn wasn't the only target. Some of Dr. Russell Sardo's records of his sessions with Brad and Cheryl during their custody battle disappeared, and Sarah Gordon received a scribbled letter that might have been meant to be reassuring, but it was unsigned, and anonymous messages frightened her. "Dr. Gordon, we heard about your testimony today. Our police friend tells us based on what you've said, they can almost arrest him, and by the end of your sworn statement, we expect he'll be in jail by end of month. Hang in there. You have our support. Your friends in Washington." What friends in Washington? What testimony? Although Sarah was prepared to testify in the civil trial, only a few people knew about it. Superstitious people, those who believe in omens and in the power of evil, might have felt a pall over the years-long quest for justice in Cheryl's murder. Oregon State Police Detective Jerry Finch, who had been the lead detective in the criminal investigation of Cheryl's death, had succumbed to lung cancer in 1988, almost exactly 2 years after Cheryl herself died. He had been in his early 40s. Connie Capato, the private investigator who had been most active in Shin's civil investigation of Cheryl's death, was barely 30 when she also developed cancer, a deadly, fast-moving malignancy of the brain. She was dead within a few months and didn't live to see the civil trial she had worked so hard on come to fruition. Nor did Bob Burnett, another PI who had worked on the case. Mike Shin and Diane Baker were not afraid, but they had long since become cautious. Nothing about this case was going to be easy. Chapter 45. We always had very nice houses. Brad insisted on a very glamorous lifestyle, Dana would recall, speaking of their sudden move in the summer of 1990. The Seattle house was brand new, and I'm not even sure where it was, except I remember it was close to the Sandpoint Naval Air Station. It was a beautiful house, over 3,000 square feet. Dana had gone willingly with Brad and his sons to Seattle in July, but within weeks she had some reservations. Being chained to a pedestal was beginning to cloy. She yearned for some small bit of freedom. She had no job, she didn't know anyone in Seattle, and her life had suddenly become only Brad. He was there everywhere she turned, not hovering, but enclosing her. He was not nearly as humble or distinguished as he had seemed to be at first. And he had a one-track mind. Brad talked about sex all the time, Dana said. Sex was his thing. I asked him not to talk the way he did, but he didn't stop. Brad tried to persuade Dana to go to topless dancing bars around Seattle, and she was appalled. Watching other women dance nude, or next to nude, was not something she wanted to do. Even though Brad was insistent that it would be fun, she refused. There were other things about Brad that puzzled her. She often found rubber gloves in his pockets, and she couldn't for the life of her figure out why he needed them. When she asked him what they were for, he was evasive. Since his estranged wife was a doctor, she supposed it was possible that Brad had access to such things, but it was something that she tried to shut away in her mind. Brad was crude, too, Dana recalled. I don't like to repeat the words he used or the way he referred to things. He'd use initials, but he'd tell me what they meant, and it was the same as if he said it all out loud. After Dana had been with Brad and the boys for 4 months, she began to feel so smothered that she could barely breathe. She was 23 and Brad was 41. Traits that had once seemed sweet and romantic now seemed like little fences going up around her. Brad clearly considered her far more than a nanny, far more even than a mistress. He talked of a future where they would always be together, and Dana wasn't ready for such a commitment. She didn't know if she ever would be. Brad had plans to move to Houston, and he assumed that she would go along. Instead, Dana left him, went back to Portland, and moved in with Nick Ronzini. It was perhaps the first time any woman had left Brad without discussion or wavering. Dana was just gone, and she was naive enough to believe she was free and clear. Brad moved to Houston. A couple of weeks later, he called and said he was in Portland, Dana said. He asked me to have dinner with him, just so we could end our being together on a friendly note. I didn't see why I shouldn't do that, so I said yes. That evening with Brad was one of the weirdest Dana ever experienced. It started out well enough. She was all dressed up, as Brad had suggested, and when she met him, he seemed to be his old, wonderfully charming self, not even upset that she had left him. He took her to a very expensive restaurant. It was one of those restaurants where they served course after course after course, Dana said. You know, salad and soup and appetizers, and then sherbet, and then something else. It was very expensive and very impressive. They had special wine that went with each course. I don't drink very much, but Brad kept urging me to. At some point during that autumn evening in Portland, Dana lost track of time and place. Everything took on a dreamy quality, and she would still sound puzzled when she remembered what happened next. When I woke up the next morning, we were in Houston. I had no idea how I got there. I didn't remember getting on a plane or leaving the restaurant. Brad just kept telling me, "I'm so in love with you, I can't live without you," and so I stayed with him in Houston. Dana had, at the very least, ambivalent feelings about Brad. She hadn't even said goodbye to Nick. One minute she was having a wonderful meal in Portland, and the next thing she knew, she was breathing in the humid, muggy air of Houston. Even if Brad loved her, he had tricked her. Nick Ronzini soon figured out where Dana was and followed her to Houston. When he tracked her to the apartment where she was living, he encountered Brad, and the two men had a fist fight. Neither won, really, but it was Nick who left. "I would have gone back to Oregon with Nick," Dana said. "But Nick had problems, and I knew that wasn't the way out. Besides, I was so insecure that I felt I was trapped with Brad." Dana had begun her tour of duty with Brad. Sometimes things were good. When Brad was happy with a woman, no man could be more charming or more fun. "I don't want to say that it was all terrible," Dana said. "Thinking back, we had a wonderful time in Houston. We did most things as a family. Brad took us to Galveston. We had parties. We had fun. We always lived in big executive homes. Brad always had new cars. When we were first in Houston, Brad had a new van. We needed a van because of the three boys." Back in Portland, Sarah hoped against hope that she was free of Brad. Her divorce was finally granted on October 21, 1990. Circuit Court Judge Kathleen Nachtigall looked over the documents showing how many of Brad's debts Sarah had to pay and listened to recountings of his vandalism of their property. She awarded the house, the Broadway bakery and bistro, its stock, the cars, the Whitewater jet boat, and all bonds, personal property, and pension assets to Sarah. Brad received his formula for Simtivir and one lot in Tampico, Washington. In addition, Judge Nachtigall denied Brad's petition for child support and ordered that he pay Sarah the sum of $50,000 immediately. If he did not, interest at 9% would accrue. He didn't pay. Sarah had paid $220,000 for the Dunthorpe house, and she estimated that she had poured more than $100,000 into it to remodel it to Brad's specifications. After they separated, she had made mortgage payments faithfully on a home occupied by her estranged husband and his nanny mistress. Real estate was booming in Lake Oswego in the late 80s and early 90s, but when Sarah finally managed in May of 1991 to sell the honeymoon house that had become a horror to her, she barely broke even. It had been an investment only in terror, and she still had the financial burden of the bakery and the bistro. Sarah's relief at having Brad gone was offset by her pain at losing her sons. From the time she had adopted them in March of 1988, she had considered them as much hers as if she had carried them in her womb. Now she had no idea where they were. Every day there was something that reminded her of Jess, Michael, and Philip, and her heart hurt thinking of them, wondering if they were safe, if they were happy. She didn't even know if they were alive. Sarah tried to believe that Brad loved the boys. It was a funny, skewed kind of love, but he had fought so hard to get them away from Cheryl that he must love them. And she took some faint comfort in the thought that Dana Malloy seemed fond of the boys. But Dana was young and would be so easily intimidated by Brad. Sarah knew that if push came to shove, as it so often did with Brad, he would tromp right over Dana. Maybe Dana wasn't even with them any longer. Brad went through women so quickly. As it happened, Dana was still with Brad. He wanted her to marry him. Brad had rarely been an unmarried man since he wed Lonnie Ann in 1969. When his marriage to Sarah officially ended in October, Brad just naturally assumed that Dana would be anxious to marry him. She wasn't. "Brad always called me his wife," Dana said, "but I just giggled when he kept proposing to me. I didn't want to marry him." Brad had carried out a carefully choreographed plan to bend Dana to his will. She didn't have the education that his other women had. She was younger than most of them, and she had never been an assertive person. Dana was adamant, however, on one point. Some instinct kept her from accepting Brad's marriage proposals. It wasn't easy. As he had with all his women, Brad quickly isolated Dana's weak points. In his most loving tone, he would call her over to show her a diagram he had drawn. With his arm around her waist, he would tap his pencil on a line near the bottom of the page. "See, Angel," he would say, "you're at this level here, and I'm way up here. You're a beautiful woman, but you're uneducated. You're gorgeous, but you're not very smart. You need me. You'll never find someone as smart as I am." She believed him, but she still wouldn't marry him. Brad talked to Dana about all his other wives. He hadn't married any of them for love, he said, and he wanted her only because he loved her. He went through the familiar litany. Lonnie Ann had been pregnant, and they were both very young when they married. Cynthia had been much older than he was, and, he told Dana, "my second marriage was purely business." He confided that he might have stayed with Lauren, but Cheryl wouldn't let me alone. She was completely obsessed with me, and I simply couldn't get away from her. As for Sarah, he said she wanted to marry me to save money on her taxes. Remembering Brad's explanations for his many failed marriages, Dana said, "At the time, that made sense to me. That made total sense to me. Especially when Brad cried and told me over and over, 'But I've never loved anyone the way I love you.'" They moved often in Houston. Each house was lovely, so Dana didn't really mind. Brad told her about the civil suit that was looming back in Oregon, something to do with his fourth wife's death. "You know, Angel," he said, "the police and the DA up there totally botched their investigation into Cheryl's murder. They're trying to get me for it because they have to have someone. The DA will lose his job if he doesn't get somebody." Dana would remember 1990 and 1991 as scary. Part of her felt sorry for Brad when she heard him sob aloud about how much he loved her, how much he needed her. And yet part of her wanted to break free of him. "He hovered over me," she said. "He was working for that law firm, Vincent and Elkins, that was handling his lawsuit. He brought me to his office every day so he could watch me, so he knew where I was." She wasn't bored exactly. "No, not really," she said. "I'd sit in the corner and read magazines while he'd work a little bit in the morning, and then we'd go out to lunch. There were hearings or trials on his lawsuit, and he took me to court with him. We went to the park or to the underground section or shopping. We had fun. It wasn't so bad. But he always watched me." It seemed to Dana that Brad was omniscient. He knew everything she did, everyone she talked to on the phone, and even what they had talked about. It was almost as if he could read her mind. "I'd call my mom, or she'd call me, and I'd tell her that I just didn't know what to do. That night, Brad would ask me if I was confused about anything, and when I said no, he'd grin and say, 'Oh, really? That's not what I heard. I heard you didn't know what to do about your life.'" Finally, Dana realized that Brad had hooked up a tape recorder to the phones in the house. He was checking on all her calls, listening to every conversation she had while he was away from home. He was becoming more obsessive, more possessive, Dana said. Brad had been insistent that he didn't want his angel to take a job in Houston. He wanted her available to him, with him all day, and on his arm looking like $1 million when he dined out with partners of Vincent and Elkins. Dana was very impressed when they went out to dinner with his high-powered attorneys. There I was, nobody really, sitting there with those wealthy lawyers. I really enjoyed going out to dinner with them, and I was happy that Brad wanted me along. It was Brad, of course, who had brainwashed Dana into believing that she was essentially nobody, a woman blessed with great physical beauty but with limited intelligence. Dana had grown used to dining in fine restaurants. She was seduced by Brad's grand lifestyle. She loved that part, but he still urged her to go to strip joints with him in Houston, just as he had tried to get her to go to girly spots in Seattle, and she still refused. One night in 1991, Brad took her to a sumptuously decorated restaurant called the Men's Club. Dana had never been to a club that was so impressive. She believed it to be a place where Houston's high society went. "I thought it was a 5-star restaurant," she remembered. "Everyone was eating filet mignon and lobster. All the women wore sequined gowns." Dana was eating her meal when she had a shocking revelation. Suddenly, beautiful young women, scantily clad, emerged from behind curtains and strutted down a stage in the center of the room. The Men's Club was not an exclusive restaurant at all. Brad had finally succeeded in getting her into a topless dancing club. It was much nicer than any of the Seattle-area clubs, but Dana saw well-dressed men slipping bills into the garter belts and G-strings the girls wore. She turned and looked at Brad accusingly. He gave her a big smile. "You're more beautiful than any of those girls up there," he said. It took a while before Dana realized that Brad must be working on another of his plans. He bought her sequined G-strings and spike heels and filmy little costumes. He had always liked to see her dressed that way. Now he suggested that she could be a star at the Men's Club. All she had to do was wear the things he bought her to wear in the privacy of their bedroom. Dana was shocked. If Brad loved her so much, how could he ask her to get up on stage and dance for other men? "You're a $100,000-a-year girl, Angel," he murmured. "You make everyone else look plain. You could do it, baby."
"But Brad," she protested.
"You know what your problem is, Angel? You're suffering from Malloyism. Your parents raised you up in a repressed small-town way. They have little closed-down minds. They do everything the same way their parents and their grandparents did. They never opened up their eyes to possibilities, and you're just like them. You're not living in reality, Angel." Besides, Brad patiently explained, he needed her to work to take a job that would help them get by until his lawsuit was settled.
"But you always said you didn't want me to work," she argued.
"Not just any job," he said. "You have it all, Dana. You have class. Your body is your fortune." She couldn't do what he asked. Not at first. Although she admired the statuesque beauties who danced at Houston's most popular club for males, Dana couldn't picture herself out there wearing only a G-string. Parading in front of strangers nearly nude was not the way she had been raised. She knew Brad would scoff at her for her Malloyism mentality, but she couldn't do what he wanted.
"If we need the money that bad, Brad," she finally said, "I'll be a cocktail waitress. Those girls get really good tips, too."
Brad grinned. "Get dressed, Angel. We're going out." Dana began as a cocktail waitress at the Men's Club. But it wasn't long before Brad convinced her she was wasting her most valuable assets.
When he opened the packages he brought home and produced beautiful, if tiny, costumes, when he told her that the men's club wasn't some sleazy honky-tonk place, but rather a showcase for the greatest beauties in Houston, Dana began to believe him. Finally, she agreed to dance, and just as he predicted, she was a real moneymaker.
"It was different in Houston," Dana would remember. "When you were one of the popular dancers at the club, you were almost a celebrity. People would come up to me in the mall and ask for my autograph. It didn't seem cheap."
Dana was Angel now, and she was much in demand. With her natural beauty, her professional knowledge as a makeup expert, and her exquisite, long-legged, full-breasted figure, she was as lovely as any movie star and more graceful. All of her years of tap, ballet, and beauty pageants made her a natural on the polished stage of the men's club. Brad had promised his angel she would have his full support, his protection, and every night after the boys were tucked in, they went to the men's club. Dana didn't like leaving the boys alone, but Jess was 10 and extremely capable, and Brad assured her he could handle any emergency that might come up. He had the number of the club and Brad's beeper number. But it was ironic, Dana thought. She had been hired as a nanny, someone to look after Jess, Michael, and Philip. Now they were home alone almost all night while she danced at the men's club and Brad watched, gloating that the woman up there desired by every man in the room was his woman.
"Each private dance was for 4 minutes, and we got $20 for that," Dana said. "If a man wanted you to come to his table, he would slip a $5 bill into your G-string."
She usually danced for 8 hours every night and was making $300 an hour or more, but Brad didn't allow her to keep any of the money for herself.
"He was waiting to take my money right after work. He told me I was selfish when I wanted to keep some."
She never had time to count the money she made dancing for rich men. She might have been surprised if she had. She wasn't a lawyer like Cheryl or a doctor like Sarah, but Dana was bringing in almost $25,000 a month. And as the dawn turned rosy over Houston, Brad and Dana drove home to one or another of the fine homes he had rented for them and his sons. Brad told Dana very little about the civil suit against him in Portland, nothing more than that the charges were trumped up and that he was the fall guy because no one really knew who had murdered Cheryl. According to what he said about Cheryl's promiscuity, it sounded as if anyone could have killed her. He warned Dana not to give out information about him to anyone. If he was on one of his trips, she wasn't to tell where he was. If he was in Houston, that went double. Chapter 46. With the civil trial set to begin in the first week of May 1991, and no indication at all from Brad Cunningham that he would be present for that trial, Mike Shin tried every channel possible to notify him. The last thing Shin wanted was for Cunningham to be able to say he had not even known there was a trial. First of all, Shin sent subpoenas to every attorney that Brad had ever employed, at least those Shin knew about, and that list alone was formidable. "I must have contacted more than a dozen of Brad's former attorneys," he said. It appeared that he had spent most of his adult life involved in litigation. They all said they were no longer in touch with him, they had no idea where he was, and they had no way of contacting him. Or if they did, they weren't saying. Since Shin knew that Brad spent a great deal of his time in Houston, he decided to look there. In early April, he hired a private investigator in the Houston area, Charles Pollard of Greenwood, Texas. Shin gave Pollard Brad's date of birth, October 14, 1948, and his social security number, 537-48-7732, and told him that Brad supposedly was living with his three small boys who were attending St. Anne's Catholic School in Houston. He should have been fairly easy to find, but Brad had become a master at hiding in plain sight. Pollard first tried the usual routes to trace an individual. He did computer checks of voter registration, assumed names, marriage license records, criminal records, and deed records in Harris County. He came up with a driver's license for Bradley Morris Cunningham, but Brad had moved from the address listed. Pollard searched through all Texas vehicle registrations and found nothing. He finally got a hit. Houston Lighting and Power had Bradley Cunningham in their records as a customer at 4824 Bel Air Boulevard, and Pollard discovered why Brad was so hard to trace. He had routinely changed one digit in his Social Security or driver's license numbers, a subtle adjustment in the age of computers that was enough to prevent someone from being found. On April 18th, Pollard went to the Bel Air Boulevard address. The neighborhood was definitely upscale, and the home where Cunningham was supposed to be living was opulent. Pollard spoke with the woman who lived next door, and she said that a dark-haired man was living there with three boys. Pollard reported this to Shin, who sent him documents to be served on Brad about the upcoming civil trial. On April 24th, Pollard returned to the Bel Air Boulevard house at 4:30 in the afternoon. He noted a blue Volkswagen van parked in the garage with the Washington license plate 567-CZD. It was the vehicle that Sarah learned Brad had bought in Washington after he dumped the pickup truck with the BBIIGG license. Pollard assumed that he would find his quarry inside the house, but it wasn't going to be as easy as it seemed at first. He rang the bell, and after a time, the door was answered by a dark-haired boy with freckles who looked to be about 8 or 9. "Is this where Bradley Cunningham lives?" Pollard asked. The dark-haired boy nodded. "But he's asleep." Before Pollard could say anything, the boy disappeared, and an extremely pretty young woman with long blonde hair came to the door. When he asked her name, she shook her head, refusing to identify herself. Pollard wondered if she might be Dana Malloy, the woman Shin believed to be living with Brad, but he wasn't going to find out from her. She seemed nervous. "I'm the babysitter," she told him with little inflection in her voice. She said Mr. Cunningham was in Portland, Oregon. "The only way I have to reach him is through some relatives of his, a Dr. Dreesen and his wife in Linwood." Grudgingly, the babysitter gave Pollard a telephone number to the Dreesen home. Pollard doubted that Cunningham really was in Portland. He suspected he was hiding in one of the bedrooms of the huge house. It was obvious that Cunningham didn't want to talk to him or to accept any papers from a lawyer in Oregon. Pollard was stubborn, however. He figured the next best place to confront Cunningham was at St. Anne's School. He arrived there the next morning at 7:30 and parked where he could watch parents dropping children off. The blue Volkswagen van didn't appear, nor did the Cunningham children. Pollard then returned to the Bel Air address. This time he saw a white Chevrolet Beretta parked in the driveway. It bore Texas plates that identified it as a rental car. He knocked on the door again, and again the same young boy answered. "My father's out of town," he said immediately. "Where's Dana?" "She's asleep. She worked late last night." Pollard asked the boy to waken Dana, and when she came to the door, he handed her the summons informing Bradley Cunningham of his impending trial. There was also a letter from Judge Ansar Haggerty, dated in February, advising the defendant of his May 6th trial date and requesting that he appear to give his deposition on May 4th. Later that day, Pollard searched deed records for the legal owners of the house on Bel Air Boulevard. As he suspected, Cunningham was renting it. The couple who owned the house said that it was indeed rented by a man named Bradley Cunningham, although it was also currently for sale. With no job and no money, and even in hiding, Brad was living well. The landlord said he was paying rent of $1,900 a month and was prompt with his payments, but they understood he was moving soon to somewhere in the Northwest, either Washington or Oregon, or perhaps even Alaska. On May 1st, 1991, Pollard delivered copies of the legal documents to the secretary of St. Anne's School. I probably won't see Mr. Cunningham, she said. He took his children out of school about a month ago. Someone in their family is very ill, and he said he was taking the boys to Portland, Oregon.
Pollard didn't tell her that the Cunningham boys weren't in Portland at all, that they were spending their days behind the closed drapes of the house on Bel Air Boulevard, only blocks from the school. There was little question in Mike Shin's mind that Brad knew about the May 6th trial date. Beyond all Shin's notifications, he had proof from Brad himself that he knew about the civil trial. Brad had written a letter to the editor of the Oregonian complaining of the odious plot against him, and in that letter he referred to the upcoming trial. He knew. In the end, however, Brad could not be bothered with such a penny-ante legal event as this civil trial, but it would proceed even if the defendant's chair was empty. Defendants in a legal action have the right to face their accusers and to defend themselves in a court of law. It is not illegal for civil defendants to absent themselves from their own trials. It is, however, highly unusual. Mike Shin had gathered scores of witnesses for the trial to be held in Judge Ansar Haggerty's courtroom. Many of them had new information, or information that they had been hesitant to reveal before. Many of them were very frightened. Sharon McCulloch, who had been Jess Cunningham's first caregiver and who had become Cheryl's close friend, wanted to testify but vacillated. "I was afraid to testify in the civil trial," she remembered. "I knew Brad. I knew the things he could do and how he just broke a strong woman like Cheryl. One day I would decide I would do it, and the next day I'd lose my nerve." Chick Preston had come on board to work the Cunningham case with Shin after Connie Capato's death. He was a remarkably good private investigator, and just before the May trial, he went to Shin bearing good news. "Doc Turco always told me to follow Brad's women, and Chick had talked to yet another one," Shin said. "I remember Chick telling me a week before the trial, 'I've found somebody. I have found you a dynamite witness. Wait until you hear what she has to say.'" Preston had talked to Karen Aborg and asked her if she would come in to see Mike Shin. She had had a brief affair with Brad in the months before Cheryl's murder and had seen him again in the days that followed. "Karen came in with her fiancé," Shin said, "and she told me, 'I'm not sure why I'm here. I have nothing that will help you.' And I just said, 'Let's wait and see.' She actually didn't know how much she knew. I knew that Karen Aborg was going to prove to be one of the missing links we'd been searching for so long." Given Brad's history of violence and intimidation, Dr. Ron Turco had warned Shin to cover his back. He wasn't just imagining things. There was every chance that Shin was in danger. Nobody knew for sure where Brad was. Dana had said he was in Portland, and perhaps he was. And he might be quietly watching Shin, waiting for a chance to take on the attorney who was causing such trouble in his life. Shin decided to listen to the advice of the experts in psychopathology he had consulted, Ron Turco among them. They suggested this was no time to be a sitting duck, or, in this case, a floating duck in his houseboat on the Multnomah Channel. He abandoned the houseboat and at least became a moving target. "I ended up living in hotels for that entire trial," Shin recalled. "I'd stay in one for a while and then move on. I didn't want Cunningham to ever get a fix on where I was." Brad might not be planning to go to his own trial.